Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, fellow liberals and Democrats, inquisitive Republicans, and concerned citizens of all backgrounds. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. Welcome aboard, and let's get to work. We have great guests on two topics today. First, Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who represents California's 14th Congressional District, talks with me about the government shutdown and debt ceiling issues. Then, Genevieve Abdo, a Middle East expert from the Brookings Institute, and I discuss Syria, Iran, and Egypt. If I have time, I'll also go over some other news of the week. And as always, we'll have our trademark weekly Hall of Fame and shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If you want to write to me and give me your opinion of any topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air. Again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. So we'll get started right after this.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
Welcome back. Last week, I had a former member of the Republican House leadership on, Dick Armey, to discuss the shutdown. This Friday, I sat down with a Democratic member of Congress to get her perspective. My next guest is the Democratic Congresswoman who represents California's 14th Congressional District, which includes the northern two-thirds of San Mateo County and the southwest quarter of beautiful San Francisco. She serves on the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, and she's also the ranking member of both the Subcommittee on Energy Policy, Healthcare and Entitlements, and the House Armed Services Committee. Representative Jackie Speier, welcome to the show, ma'am.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Congresswoman Speier, here we are, Friday, October 11th, on the 11th day of a government shutdown. We're facing the real possibility of a government default on our debt, and polls show that a large majority of people blame the congressional Republicans for this mess, and I think they're right to do that. You just got finished participating in some debates on the Hill regarding this whole mess. Can you update us on the latest?
Well, there is not a lot to update you on because every time we take a step forward, we tend to take a couple of steps back. The glimmer of hope is the fact that people are talking now as opposed to just digging their heels in the sand. The Republicans offered up a proposal to the White House that was asking for the moon. It was rejected. The Senate now, led by Susan Collins, is proposing a one-year debt limit, opening up the government, continuing resolution, delaying the medical device tax, and possibly one or two others, which is gaining bipartisan support in the Senate. The drill would then mean to have it passed, come over to the House. In all likelihood, the House Republicans won't accept it. They will tinker with it. It'll be sent back to the Senate. And so we'll have this ping-pong going on for a couple of days. I'm hopeful that by the middle of next week, we have the government reopened and the debt ceiling lifted.
I think what you just talked about highlights a split that exists in the Republican Party between sort of these reasonable folks like Susan Collins and some others, and the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party that really, it's really hard to relate to those folks. I had Dick Armey on my show last week, and he said that Speaker Boehner and various other House Republicans really didn't want to go along with shutting down the government. But he feared losing his leadership position in the House. Others feared being primaried from the right the next time they're up for re-election if they didn't go along. Do you get the sense that this is true from what you know of your friends on the other side of the aisle in Congress?
I think that's pretty accurate. I think that it was all about me and not all about thee. And the result is that we have a scenario where people are really concerned all over this country. I mean, when you've got states willing to pay the federal government, the Department of Interior, to open up the national parks because their local businesses have lost $750 million in tourism dollars because of the national parks nationwide being closed. I mean, that's real hurt. That's real hurt to states, to small businesses. And we kind of lose sight of that in this little brinksmanship that's being played out here. The other thing that's kind of ironic is the fact that we have passed a bill. It's passed the House. The Senate is holding it at the moment. The President has already agreed to sign it, which basically says all the furloughed employees within the federal workforce, some 800,000 that are in that category right now, would be paid as if they had worked. Now, I want them to come back to work, and I think it is ludicrous that that bill is passed. I voted for it because I wanted to see them come back to work, but they are now getting paid for not working, and they're not providing the services to the taxpayers that they should be providing for the money that they normally earn. So the Republicans on the House side have done themselves a huge disservice, and they've been led by Ted Cruz, unfortunately, who is the speaker in absentia on the House side.
Yeah, he and it's really clear that his only interest is Ted Cruz and his presidential ambitions in 2016. What was it, a quote I heard from a Republican who refused to be named, that he led the Republican Party out in the middle of the street and left it there? I mean, boy.
What a number.
Well, let me tell you, I've talked to a lot of Republicans in the House that feel that they have really been done in by him, that they followed him, and it has led them into the desert. So I think that there's a lesson to be learned here on many counts. But you don't play with the full faith and credit of the United States. You don't use gimmicks. You're either authentic about what you believe or you're not. I mean, to go from, we're going to shut down the government because we want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, to now we're going to keep the government shut down because we want some reforms in entitlement. So it's sort of like this whack-a-mole.
Yeah, and they don't really seem to be clear about what they want. You know, I was on Fox News Thursday night, and I made the point that it's the best thing for the country if the Republicans do not get any concessions from this. I don't think the folks I was on really understood that, but if they do, the precedent will be set. And from now on, every time we have divided government, like we have now, the minority group may very well use this or a similar tactic to try to get their way, and the country will be going through these crises over and over again. And I'm not sure Republicans in their base seem to get that. That's what they're trying to do here, and it would not be a precedent for good government. I mean, what's your perspective on that?
Well, I think it will be a part of the tool chest that will be used in the future. I think that genie is out of the out of the lamp. I saw it happen in California over 18 years in the state legislature, where really a minority could hold the state hostage in the budget process because it was a two-thirds vote requirement. Once we made it 55% and linked it to, you don't have a budget out of time, you don't just have your salary postponed, you actually forego your salary, you forfeit your salary, as a very it's very effective in terms of getting people to do their jobs.
Yeah, and, you know, Republicans, it's completely their fault that, you know, all this stuff is happening. You were at the White House on Wednesday discussing the shutdown with the president and his staff. What kind of things were discussed at that meeting? What kind of things was the president telling you as far as what his position was?
Well, I was pretty impressed with the fact that the president was very clear about not negotiating in a hostage environment, that he was not willing to do a six-week extension with some strings attached to it, that he's willing to negotiate, but not under circumstances that he's got his hands tied behind his back. I think he's been helped immeasurably by the majority leader and the Senate President Pro Tem, because Harry Reid has been just steadfast in keeping his caucus together, and he's got some senators that are really in tough reelection bids, but he's held them together. They've been unanimous in their position, and he has shown incredible leadership.
I've been very impressed with Senator Reid lately. He has been really showing a lot of backbone here. He gets a lot of criticism, I think, from Democrats for on occasion appearing not to maybe perhaps be so steadfast, but he has been rock solid here. He's been fantastic. One of the things that's really been disturbing to me that has come out in the last few days, I'm really scared, and I think most Americans who have 401ks and retirement plans are really afraid of what this defaulting on the debt could mean to our economy, to the markets. But in the last few days, some of these congressional Republicans and certain conservative pundits have been downplaying the risk of not raising the debt ceiling, suggesting that defaulting or on all or part of our debts wouldn't be that big of a deal, wouldn't impact the economy. What do you think when you hear nonsense like that? I mean, what are these people thinking?
Well, they really are individuals who are ignorant. And I don't care who you point to as an economist, whether they're conservative or liberal, they all say the same thing. This is deadly. This is Armageddon. I mean, when we were just tinkering with the idea of not lifting the debt ceiling back in 2011, it had a profound effect. 200,000 jobs were lost because of it, and something like $600 billion of savings of the American people in 401ks and the like were lost.
Wow.
Because we were just tinkering with it. So they are living in la-la land, and maybe they should go back there because they really are ignorant about the ramifications.
Yeah, sometimes I think Republicans just live in an entirely alternate reality. I don't think some of them really understand the economy or fiscal issues. You know, we keep talking about that, or how playing games with our solvency can have a lot of unintended consequences. Speaking of unintended consequences, in a news release the other day, you characterized the shutdown as a dreamland for enemies that want to steal our nation's secrets. What did you mean by that?
The shutdown has literally furloughed 70% of the intelligence community in this country. They've been furloughed. So if you want to put the welcome mat down for any terrorist that's been, you know, planning any kind of a particular attack, well, this is a great time to do it because we're missing 70% of the people that normally work in that arena. So it is so foolish to carry on with this charade as long as we have it. And for all the measures, piecemeal measures that the Republicans have kind of propped up and touted over the last few weeks that we have basically rejected because we don't want to do it piecemeal, they represent less than a quarter of the federal government.
Wow.
So even those efforts being seen as being positive really are just a small part of the entire federal function.
If you had to put some sort of percentage chance, what do you think that we will have a deal next week that helps us avoid the defaulting on our debt and reopens the government?
Well, I can tell you 100% we will have a bill on lifting the debt ceiling.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I'd say 65% that we'll have reopen the government.
Really?
So I guess that sounds, I'm pretty optimistic.
That is pretty optimistic. But on the other hand, you think congressional Democrats on both houses and the president would agree to an uncoupling of those issues potentially?
Well, I think it's not sound policy to decouple them. I also think it's pretty ridiculous to make this a huge lift when we're talking about 6 weeks or 2 months. You know, if we're doing 6 weeks and 2 months, we should be able to do that like yesterday. I mean, that gives them another, you know, two or three bites at the apple. But that's the kind of high-stakes poker they're playing right now. And, you know, even the Wall Street Journal today, it delights me when the Wall Street Journal takes on the Republican Party. A couple of weeks ago, they wrote an editorial about the Republicans in terms of their recalcitrance and lifting the debt ceiling, and to your point about the ones that think that it's not going to be a problem. And the headline, I think, read something like, "Republicans, are you nuts?" And today, on, you know, like page A5 of the Wall Street Journal, they're talking about how the most recent Wall Street Journal NBC poll has now found that the Republicans have the lowest positive percentage of support in this country since they've been actually recording it.
I think they have lower approval than root canals at this point. I think that's how bad they're doing. But
you know, it's funny. You get such a different take when you look at, for instance, Wall Street Journal and other conservative pundits and publications. Some of them are trying to pretend that it's hurting President Obama. I saw one pundit the other day say that President Obama is down to a 37% approval level. I've never seen that poll. All the polling I've seen on the president shows him in the mid-40s. And like you said, all the polls on the Republicans and key Republicans like Cruz and Boehner show that they're just completely in the tank right now. The Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, I hope, really faces some problems for this. How are you looking as far as 2014? Has this totally re-energized the DCCC and other Democratic organizations looking forward to 2014? Do you think this is going to make a real difference?
I think that it has re-energized the Democrats, no question about it. And it is still a heavy lift for us to gain 17 seats, but we could do it. And this is the kind of outrageous conduct that will drive voters away from Republican candidates. Just the memory of this morass, I think, could be very, very painful for them. So time will tell.
Time will tell. We'll have to end it there. She's the Congresswoman representing California's 14th Congressional District, Representative Jackie Speier. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure, Steve.
I was encouraged by Congresswoman Speier saying that she was 100% certain that we'll avoid defaulting on all or part of our debts by raising the debt ceiling. But on another note, one that really made me unhappy, she pointed out, probably correctly, that the genie is out of the bottle in terms of a party in the minority in government but leading one half of Congress, like Republicans do today, using these same tactics that they're using to hold the country hostage to try to get their way on an issue, or multiple issues. That's the precedent that these Tea Party Republicans have helped set. And this precedent will be the source of a lot of misery for this country going forward. Thanks, Tea Party. We'll be right back.
We don't get fooled again.
What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets.
Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. With all the focus on the shutdown and debt ceiling, we as a country haven't been talking about the crises in Syria and Egypt, and perhaps haven't covered the aftermath of our tentative reach out to Iran as much as we should be. To get you up to speed, I reached out to one of the foremost experts on the Middle East from the top-rated think tank in the world. My next guest is a journalist, scholar, and author of three books on the Middle East and the Muslim world. She's currently a non-resident fellow in the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute and a fellow in the Middle East program at the Stimson Center think tank. Her comments and essays on Islam have appeared in Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy Magazine, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Washington Quarterly, The New Republic, Newsweek, The Nation, The Christian Science Monitor, CNN, and Middle East Report. She's been a commentator on CNN, National Public Radio, the BBC, the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, the Oprah Winfrey Show, Al Jazeera, PBS, and various other radio and television services. So we're lucky to have her. She lectures frequently at universities and think tanks in the United States, Europe, and the Middle East. Genevieve Abdo, welcome to the show, ma'am.
Thank you very much for having me, Steve.
What I would like to do for my listeners is to really get them both a broad and deep understanding of three particular hot areas in the Middle East. So to set the table, I want to talk about a great article you wrote for CNN back in June that talked about a broadening sectarian conflict, not just in Syria, but in the greater Middle Eastern region. Can you talk about the dynamics of that conflict, which countries are affected and which religious sects are involved?
Sure. It's been a bit surprising that about in the spring, the media started reporting that there was a sectarian conflict in Syria, because I think that, as you mentioned, it's a regional conflict. And even though people are more focused on Syria, I think that it's a conflict that's been developing, has been underway really since the invasion of Iraq. And it's a theological dispute that we're talking about. It's a political dispute, and it stems from, in recent years and since the invasion of Iraq, it really stems from the weakening of states. That's one cause. So there's been this, of course, long, long history of the conflict between Shia and Sunni Muslims, but it resurfaced because autocrats left power. In the case of Iraq, of course, Saddam Hussein, he repressed the Shia population, which is not the majority in Iraq. The Sunnis are the majority, but there is a sizable and significant Shia population. And he was very, very autocratic and didn't allow the Shia political or social or economic rights. So, of course, when he was ousted from power, this became a big issue in Iraq. The similar case is now underway in Syria, whereby, of course, we have a very, very brutal civil war there, and you have this struggle going on between the Alawites, who actually are not even considered by some Muslims to be a branch of Shia Islam, but are considered by others to be Shia Muslims. So you have the Alawites that are in power over a Sunni majority. And again, you know, the war there has reignited this long historical conflict. And, you know, the Sunnis, for the most part, don't believe that because the Alawites are a minority that they should rule the government. And, of course, there haven't been free elections in Syria for decades. So those are those two countries. And then you have, of course, in Lebanon, very complicated society where there are different strands of Sunni Muslims. There, of course, are Shia in Lebanon. And you had a civil war there that lasted 15 years and only ended in 1990. So, again, it's been reignited in Lebanon. And So the cause, one of the causes is that all these countries have weak states, but another cause really is that since the Arab uprisings began, a lot of people in the Middle East are much more attached to their religious identities than they were in the past. And, you know, you see this in Egypt, you see this in Lebanon, in Bahrain, another country that has been undergoing an uprising there that's, for the most part, led by Shia Muslims, even though there is some support among the Sunni population. And again, in all these countries, I think that what the Arab uprisings unleashed was not only a recalculation of the sort of political dynamics, but also a return to sort of identity politics, whether it's about, you know, your religion or even if it's about gender. So there's a search for, I think, a national identity. There's a search for personal identities. And this is why in all of these countries we're now seeing this conflict that is both religious and political.
That really sounds something that's, I guess, from my standpoint and the standpoint of Americans, probably scary, something to be concerned about. And unfortunately, you know, the United States has played a role. As you mentioned, we took out Saddam Hussein. We're involved to some extent in Syria and Egypt. Whether you consider our involvement as something less than a genuine attempt to help, which I think was probably the case in Iraq, or President Obama wanting to get involved in Syria for really what are probably positive attempts to help, it just seems like we don't seem to completely understand all of the dynamics and possible unintended consequences. Speaking of which, where do you see the United States with Syria? And I'm not so much talking about from an administration perspective, but from the effect that the United States has had in Syria over the last 6 to 12 months. For a while, it looked like we were going to have a strike on Syria. Then almost no one in the international community seemed to support us on that. I wasn't in favor of a strike. Then the Russians got involved. Perhaps they were involved all along, but they really got involved to help broker a solution to the chemical weapons issue. Where does all of that stand now? All of a sudden, you didn't hear anything about Syria in the last 6 weeks or so. So is the risk of U.S. military involvement in Syria seemingly over at this point?
It seems so. And, you know, you raise a really good point about the U.S. involvement in the Middle East. And it's the U.S. role in the Middle East has really fundamentally changed since the Arab uprisings began. And the United States is far less influential. It has far less ability to control what happens. Syria is a perfect example of that. So you have this raging civil war. You have an increasing involvement of jihadists and also Salafists. Some are more moderate than others. You have Al-Qaeda now involved. You have, you know, this combustible mix between all of these players, and then Iran's involvement, their Islamic Revolutionary Guards in Syria. And I think that the administration has reached the conclusion very reluctantly that it's better to have some sort of transitional government in place in Syria that would ease out the current president, Bashar al-Assad, but retain some of the most remnants of the regime.
You know, the other thing, I keep talking about the United States. Well, my audience is probably most interested in how the United States is acting here. And one of the things, again, that occurs to me is, from what I understand, the Iranians reached out to the Bush regime at least twice early in his first term to try to restart negotiations. And I'm thinking just of all of the missed opportunities to try to head off what we now see in the Middle East. Speaking of Iran, I want to dive into that, into our relationship with them a little bit more. Tentative first steps were taken with Iran and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, and one of the things that we see that came of that was a mild rebuke by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei for going too far too fast. Since it seems that all of these things really have some interrelation, our relationship with Iran could affect very much how well things go in Syria, I think it's important to take an integrated approach, and I think our relationship with the Iranians can really make the difference in how things work here. How should President Obama proceed with the Iranians, with President Rouhani, given that their recent interactions did seem to have a bit of a cost for the Iranian president?
Well, I mean, Steve, you raise a really important point, which is the integration of all these issues that concern the United States and Iran. People tend to only focus on the nuclear issue. And the Iranian, from the Iranian perspective, and as you mentioned, the years that there were negotiations were actually in 2003 over Afghanistan. So the Iranians actually were very helpful with the United States in identifying al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan. And from their point of view, I'm just speaking from their point of view, they feel that the only thing they got in return for their assistance and help was that George Bush declared them part of the axis of evil. I think that you know, we have to be mindful in the United States that even though there appears to be a more moderate government in place in Iran, that it's a very, very complicated, entangled political system. And Rouhani is walking a real tightrope. And that's why you see what appears to be sort of conflicting sentiments coming from Khamenei. When Rouhani was here at the UN, when he was in New York at the UN, he was he endorsed Rouhani's diplomacy. When Rouhani came back to Iran, there was protesting against him for accepting the call from President Obama from his performance at the UN. The Islamic Revolutionary Guards, these are the hardliners, which are in charge of sort of the military apparatus and the security apparatus in Iran. The general, the head person in the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, criticized Rouhani and said, "Don't trust the United States, and you know we have decision-making power too." They saw these kinds of statements coming out of key factions within the government. So I think we have to be mindful that he walks a political tightrope, and this is why you see Khamenei, who's really a balancer in this political system. He tries to balance all these political factions so that there aren't, I guess, conflicts within the government.
I feel like this is something that the United States really should not, this is an opportunity we should not miss. Like you said, there's a lot that has been going on the Iranian side, and some of it has been really fascinating because in the last 34 years or so since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, I think the United States and most of us citizens here have seen Iran as this sort of monolithic entity that's, you know, calling the United States the Great Satan and chanting death to America. We haven't really stopped and taken a look at some of the complexities in Iran itself. We're seeing that now. You talked about the different factions, the Republican Guard, Khamenei, and how, you know, no one really seems 100% in control. Even Khamenei has to respect some of the different factions. So with that said, how about what should President Rouhani do? He seems not really to have as much flexibility, perhaps, as we thought. How will he approach the issue of improving relations with the United States going forward after all that's transpired in the last few weeks? I don't want his job, let's put it that way.
Good point. I mean, I think you will see him treading very carefully. And I think that we will see him also making some demands, or at least the people who are representing Iran in the nuclear talks in Geneva.
Let's talk about the very central question here that I think is on the minds of a lot of people in the U.S. and in Western Europe. And that is, do you believe the Iranian contention that their nuclear energy program is purely peaceful and has no weapons aspect to it? Because I think that's at the bottom, you know, we have the Iranians saying, look, we are allowed to produce nuclear energy. We just want it for civilian purposes. We're not refining uranium to the point where it's weaponizable. And you have people on the West in the United States who dispute that. The United Nations has had weapons inspectors sampling the uranium coming out of the centrifuges. But if there's no agreement as to what even the truth is of that, I think there's problems right away in the negotiations, right?
Yes, and the problem is, to be perfectly frank, that the Iranians have not been transparent with the AEIA, the nuclear agency that monitors nuclear facilities the IAEA. They have not been transparent with UN inspectors. So there is a history of deception on the Iranian side, which makes it very difficult. I mean, in 2002, it was actually the what we call the MEK. They're a somewhat renegade opposition group. They don't represent the opposition inside Iran, but they call themselves the opposition. They actually revealed that Iran had a nuclear facility it was hiding, and that turned out to be correct. This was in 2002. So the Iranians don't have a good track record of transparency, and this is why people are skeptical. I mean, obviously for good reasons. The obvious question is, if you have a nuclear program that you say is only for civilian purposes, then why are you enriching uranium at 20%? Why are you doing all these other things? This is not, you don't need to do this if your program is only for civilian purposes. So, you know, the Iranians have a lot to answer for on in terms of you know, the purpose of their program.
We just cut military aid to Egypt to show our displeasure with how the coup played out. A Cairo-based agency, Ahram, called it wrong in terms of content and timing. Is the cut in aid a good strategy for our long-term relationship with Egypt and its fledgling, what's left of its fledgling democracy?
I look at the cutting of aid a bit differently. I think that the United States made so many errors since President Mubarak was ousted from power that cutting aid is sort of the last gasp of this conflict between the United States and everybody in Egypt, not just the transitional military government, but the conflict of brotherhood. We, in the United States, I think we tend to look at this cutting of aid, oh, well, we showed the Egyptians, yeah, we're cutting their aid. Well, in fact, the Egyptians, a lot of Egyptians want the aid to be cut. They want the United States out of Egypt. They don't want the United States influential in Egypt anymore. The United States has alienated the Muslim Brotherhood. It's alienated the liberals. It's alienated the military, and it has very little leverage now in Egypt because of bad policy decisions. I spent a lot of time in Egypt this spring and lived there for many years and have been going to Egypt for about 25 years, and I can tell you that there's more anti-Americanism in Egypt now than I've ever seen. And when President Morsi came to power, the Obama administration did the right thing. They recognized him as the president of Egypt, but what followed was somewhat of a disaster. I mean, what followed is that rather than deciding, okay, we're backing this man, he was democratically elected, the Egyptian people put him in power, he's the first elected Egyptian president, we're going to work with him, we're going to support his government, we're going to reprimand him when he gets out of line, so to speak. Instead of that, they had this very, very incoherent policy. I think that at times they were critical of President Morsi, but they didn't put the kind of pressure on him that was necessary, which I think he would have responded to and the Brotherhood would have responded to and taken very seriously.
Do you think the United States really could have stopped Morsi from trying to grab the extra power that he did? My understanding is that's really what happened and what prompted the coup is that he tried to become essentially another Mubarak, grab absolute power to pass laws and usurped all of the court's power. I don't think that he would have listened to the United States, but you think that he would have. You think he would have responded to United States pressure there?
I think he would have responded to international pressure because people, I agree, I'm not defending President Morsi's one-year term in office. I mean, he wanted to retire many of the judges. You know, there was some sort of law proposed that judges over the age of, I think, 65 or 70 should be retired because they were from the Mubarak era, and he wanted to cleanse the judiciary of Mubarak influences. So, yes, he took a lot of – he overstepped his powers in many respects. But I think that what people didn't understand, and I say this as someone who has written a book about the Brotherhood, who's conducted research about the Brotherhood, who's interviewed – all these people over many years, I think that what the United States didn't understand is that they do care about Western opinion. And they do. And so had there been a lot of international pressure from the Europeans, from the United States, I think that the Brotherhood would have, or at least some members of the Brotherhood, some of the leaders, would have taken this very seriously.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Janeth Abdo, Middle East expert and fellow in the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute. Thank you for spending time with us today, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
We'll be right back with our Hall of Fame and Shame after this.
Blinded by the light.
And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Winning the Hall of Fame this week is Arizona's Republican Senator John McCain. While most Republicans in Congress and most conservative pundits are publicly saying that the shutdown is a good thing and a winning strategy, including those in both groups who I know for a fact do not agree with it, there are some who are calling it out for the insanity and the inanity that it is. Among that small group of Republicans with their heads screwed on right, at least on this issue, one of the more vocal is Arizona Senator John McCain. In interviews on both CNN and Fox News last week, Senator McCain shocked his interviewers by calling out the Tea Party and other non-specified architects of the GOP shutdown in no uncertain terms. On Fox News, the interviewer asked Senator McCain about whether the White House made a mistake with shutting down military memorials. Let's listen.
Oh, I think it's been terribly handled by the White House, but let's have a little straight talk, Martha. They wouldn't have had the opportunity to handle it that way if we had not shut down the government on a fool's errand that we were not going to accomplish. The whole premise of shutting down the government was the repeal of Obamacare. I fought against Obamacare harder than any of the people who wanted to shut down the government. I campaigned all over this country in 2012 saying elect Mitt Romney and we'll repeal and replace Obamacare. We weren't going to defund Obamacare, and so we shut down the government, and then that gave the opportunity for this to be terribly, awfully mismanaged and mishandled by the White House. If we hadn't shut down the government, this wouldn't have happened. And they shut down the government with a fool's errand that would not succeed, and that's a fact.
A fool's errand. You can't say it any better than that. I agree with that characterization of John McCain, and I mean that from a Republican perspective. I can put myself in their shoes for a little while. It doesn't feel comfortable, but I can squeeze those shoes on. This is a disaster for them. It's colossally stupid and self-destructive. Republicans who have any sense about them at all should be copying down all the names of the folks involved in the decision-making that got us here and primary them out of office the next time they're up for re-election. And again, I'm telling you, that's from the Republican perspective. I'm not trying to be a Democrat. I'm not trying to hurt the Republican Party by saying, I'm actually trying to help them. I don't like giving advice to Republicans. I'm giving you well-meaning advice here. From a general American perspective, what these idiots in the Republican Party have done to America and to our government and our economy with this nonsense is even worse. So congratulations to Arizona Senator John McCain for winning our Hall of Fame this week for making great sense. But now we have our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense.
All aboard!
In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have Congressman Morgan Griffith. For those of you who don't know, Republican Congressman Morgan Griffith represents Virginia's 9th Congressional District. He's one of those folks who came to power with the Tea Party class of 2010. Yeah, one of those geniuses. He's the opposite of folks like Senator John McCain and Congressman Peter King and Senator Susan Collins. He's one of the crazies that McCain and King need to eject from their party. Congressman Griffith was asked about a compromise bill that was being crafted by Senate Republicans
to end the government shutdown and raise the debt ceiling. This was late this past week, Friday. In short, he was asked about a bill that would end the crisis that we're in now. The Hill's Russell Berman and Eric Wasson report that Griffith suggested that even if it resulted in a severely damaging default, the House should reject the agreement crafted by Senate Republicans. Congressman Griffith said, and I quote, "We have a decision that's right long-term for the United States, and what may be distasteful, unpleasant, and not appropriate in the short run may be something that has to be done. I will remind you that this group of renegades that decided that they wanted to break from the crown in 1776 did great damage to the economy of the colonies. They created the greatest nation and the best form of government, but they did damage to the economy in the short run." This is this lunatic who's been in Congress for a little more than 2 years trying to justify what they're doing by comparing themselves to the revolutionary heroes of this country 200 plus years ago. These Tea Party whack jobs, they love to compare themselves to the heroes of the American Revolution. They have nothing in common with them. The leaders of the American Revolution had to flee their homes. They had to live on the run, and they were risking their lives. These Tea Party whack jobs in Congress, like Morgan Griffith, spew their nonsense from nice offices on Capitol Hill. They get paid high salaries and drink expensive scotch in Washington, D.C. bars after work. They have nothing in common with the heroes who risked their lives and everything else to bring democratic self-rule to the colonies. So no, Congressman Griffith, you're not like the heroes of revolutionary times, and a default on our debt would be nothing like the American Revolution. Congressman Morgan Griffith is third place this week in our Hall of Shame for worst nonsense of the week. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have Senator Ted Cruz. So if you thought that Congressman Morgan Griffith's rhetoric was crazy, you haven't heard anything yet. Texas Senator Ted Cruz attended the Values Voter Summit on Friday in Washington, D.C., and picked up right where his ridiculous 21-hour Ashton Kutcher, Freddy vs. Jason, Dr. Seuss, Green Eggs and Ham nonsense left off. Here's a piece from his speech at that summit.
You look at our Constitution, you look at our Bill of Rights, this is an administration that seems bound and determined to violate every single one of our Bill of Rights. I don't know that they've yet violated the Third Amendment, but I expect them to start quartering soldiers in people's homes soon.
Who buys this is what I want to know. Actually, you know what? I'm going to answer my own question about who buys it. Cruz won a Republican presidential nomination straw poll at that Values Voter Summit, and he won it easily with 42% of the vote. And the next highest, just to get you an idea of how big he won this straw poll at this Values Voter Summit, the next highest vote getters were Ben Carson and Rick Santorum, both at 13%. So he won it by almost 30% over the next highest vote getters at the summit. You know, Republicans try to stop African Americans from voting with all of these crazy things like voter ID laws, but the people who buy this nonsense from Ted Cruz, those are the folks who shouldn't be allowed near a voting booth, okay? Even if we allow Cruz the courtesy of assuming that this is sarcasm or irony, it's not funny. The Affordable Care Act was passed by Congress, upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, as constitutional. Everything this president has done has been constitutional. He hasn't broken any laws or exceeded his authority in any way. Speaking, though, of whether presidents broke the law and exceeded their authority, where was Ted Cruz during George W. Bush's presidency? If you want to rant about presidents who broke the law and exceeded presidential authority, you had a gold mine there. Exceeding the mandate of the Iraq War Resolution and going to war when there was no breach of UN resolutions, no weapons of mass destruction, no threat to the United States, lying to the American people about the reasons to go to war in Iraq, engaging in a war of aggression, torturing, using extraordinary rendition, warrantless wiretapping, and we can go on. But there wasn't a peep from Ted Cruz during all of that. And you know where Ted Cruz was during that time? He was the Solicitor General of Texas from 2003 to 2008, one of the highest law enforcement officials in that state. If he was a stickler for constitutional authority, he could have said something about Bush's abuses from that platform. But no, nothing about presidential abuses about George W. Bush from Ted Cruz. But the country elects a Democrat, and then the crazy, over-the-top hyperbole about presidential lawbreaking rolls off of his tongue. Senator Ted Cruz is runner-up this week in our Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense. And by the way, Senator McCain, I think you and other more reasonable Republican senators need to take Mr. Cruz to a back room in the Capitol and give him an old-fashioned military blanket party. But Cruz's nonsense was not the worst last week. Oh, no. The award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to three pro-gun groups: the Second Amendment Foundation, the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, and DefendGunRights.com. These groups, you know what, I just want to yell obscenities at them for a few minutes and call it a day. But it's radio, so I can't do that. Now, you might be wondering, what could get me, someone who never uses profanity, what could get me in the mood to just want to scream four-letter words at some group for a few minutes? Well, these three groups, the Second Amendment Foundation, the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, and DefendGunRights.com, have decided, in their wisdom, to proclaim this December 14th, the one-year anniversary of the Newtown Massacre, where all of these little children were killed. They've decided to proclaim that day as, quote, Guns Save Lives Day. I'm not kidding. I would not make a vile joke like that. These groups decided that it was a good idea to mock the anniversary of the death of these children by calling it Guns Save Lives Day. Now you know why I want to just start screaming four-letter words at these people. Now I'm going to try to remain somewhat fair here and read a statement from what these guys listed as their reasoning. The Sacramento Bee reports on a press release that these groups put out saying, Guns Save Lives Day is dedicated to reminding people that crazy people, criminals, and gun control extremists prefer unarmed victims. The event is decided to counteract what certainly will be a day of activism and misinformation from the gun prohibition lobby. We wanted to ensure that the public has the facts on gun rights and understands how many Americans stand with them in defense of Second Amendment rights. And that's a quote from Larry Ward, founder of DefendGunRights.com. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. You know what? Larry Ward and everyone else at these three groups, you are a bunch of sick, inhuman SOBs. And that's about as close as I can come to telling you how I really feel without getting me and the stations that carry my show a hefty fine from the FCC. The groups called the Second Amendment Foundation, the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, and DefendGunRights.com win the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. Folks in those groups, you guys really should be ashamed of yourselves. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, October 20th, and Monday, October 21st at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter at Steven Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.